Chapter 4, Architecture of Emotional and Psychosomatic Disorders, Part 2.
The stakes and his motivation to succeed were very high, but the challenge was truly formidable. The task he was supposed to perform was something he had never done in his life, a head-first dive into a swimming pool from a 30-foot-high tower. The biographical layer of his coex system consisted of reliving the enormous ambivalence and fear associated with the dive, as well as the sensations of falling. The deeper layer of the same coex that immediately followed this experience was the reliving of Ralph's struggle in the final stage of birth, with all the emotions and physical sensations involved. The process then continued into what Ralph concluded must have been a past life experience. He became an adolescent boy in a native culture who was involved with a group of peers in a dangerous rite of passage. One after the other, they climbed to the top of a tower made of wooden poles tied together with flexible vegetable tendrils. Once there, they attached the end of a long liana to their ankles and fixed its other end to the edge of the platform at the top of the tower. It was a status symbol and matter of great pride to have the longest liana and not to get killed. When he experienced the feelings associated with the jump in this rite of passage, he realized that they were very similar both to the feelings associated with his dive in the Olympic camp and to those he encountered in the final stages of birth. All three situations were clearly integral parts of the same coex. Zoophobia, from the Greek zoon, meaning animal or organism, the fear of various animals, can involve many different forms of life, both large and dangerous beasts, as well as small and harmless creatures. It is essentially unrelated to the actual danger that a particular animal represents for humans. In classical psychoanalysis, the feared animal was seen as a symbolic representation of the castrating father or the bad mother, and always had a sexual connotation. The work with holotropic states has shown that such a biographical interpretation of zoophobias is inadequate, and that these disorders have significant perinatal and transpersonal roots. If the object of the phobia is a large animal, the most important element seemed to either be the theme of being swallowed and incorporated, wolf, or the relation to pregnancy and nursing, cow. It was mentioned earlier that the archetypal symbolism of the onset of BPM2 is the experience of being swallowed and incorporated. This perinatal fear of engulfment can easily be projected on large animals, particularly predators. Classical examples of the relationship between a large animal and birth are the fairy tale about Little Red Riding Hood and the biblical story of Jonah, with their perinatal symbolism of being swallowed. Certain animals also have a special symbolic association with the birth process, such as gigantic tarantulas, which frequently appear in the initial phase of BPM2 as symbols of the devouring feminine. This seems to reflect the fact that spiders catch free-flying insects in their webs, immobilize them, envelop them, and kill them. It is not difficult to see a similarity between this sequence of events and the experiences of the child during biological delivery. This connection seems to be essential for the development of arachnophobia, fear of spiders, from the Greek arachne, meaning spider. Another zoophobia that has an important perinatal component is ophiophobia, or serpentophobia, the fear of snakes, from the Greek ophis and Latin serpens, meaning snake. Images of snakes, which on a more superficial level have a phallic connotation, are common symbols representing the birth agony, and thus the terrifying and devouring feminine. Poisonous snakes represent the threat of imminent death, and also the beginning of the initiatory journey. See the frescoes in Pompeii, representing a Dionysian ritual. While large boa-type constrictors symbolize the crushing and strangulation involved in birth. The fact that large constrictor snakes swallow their prey and appear pregnant further reinforces the perinatal association. The serpentine symbolism typically extends deep into the transpersonal realm, where it can have many different culturally specific meanings, such as the snake from the Garden of Eden, who deceived Eve. The snake representing the serpent power Kundalini, the snake Muchalinda, protecting the Buddha against rain, Vishnu's endless snake Ananta, the Mesoamerican plumed serpent Quetzalcoatl, the rainbow serpent of the Australian Aborigines, and many others. Entomophobia, the phobia of insects, from the Greek entomos, meaning insect, can frequently be traced back to the dynamics of perinatal matrices. Bees, for example, seem to be related to reproduction and pregnancy because of their role in the transfer of pollen and fertilization of plants, as well as their ability to cause swelling in humans. Flies, as a result of their affinity for excrement and their propensity to spread infection, are associated with the scatological aspect of birth. As has already been pointed out, this has a close relation to phobias of dirt and microorganisms and the compulsive washing of hands. Keraunophobia, the pathological fear of thunderstorms, from the Greek keraunos, meaning thunderbolt, is psychodynamically related to the transition between BPM 3 and BPM 4, and thus to the ego death. Lightning represents an energetic connection between heaven and earth, and electricity is a physical expression of divine energy. For this reason, an electric storm symbolizes the contact with the divine light that occurs at the culmination of the death-rebirth process. During psychedelic sessions in Prague, several of my patients relived electroshocks that had been administered to them in the past. They remained conscious throughout the entire experience, even though in the original situation, the electric shocks knocked them unconscious. They had these experiences when their process of psycho-spiritual transformation had reached the point of the ego death. It is interesting that one of the theories trying to explain the therapeutic effect of electroshocks actually suggested that the procedure induced the experience of psycho-spiritual death and rebirth. The most famous keraunophobic was Ludwig von Beethoven. He succeeded in confronting the subject of his fear when he included a magnificent musical representation of a thunderstorm in his pastoral symphony. Pyrophobia, the pathological fear of fire, from the Greek pyre, meaning fire, also has deep psychological roots in the transition from BPM 3 to BPM 4. When we discussed the phenomenology of the perinatal matrices, we saw that individuals approaching the ego death typically have visions of fire. They also often experience their body burning and feel like they are passing through purifying flames, pyrocatharsis. The motif of fire and purgatory is thus an important concomitant of the final stage of psycho-spiritual transformation. When this aspect of the unconscious dynamics reaches the threshold of consciousness, the liaison between the experience of fire and the impending ego death gives rise to pyrophobia. In those individuals who are able to intuit the positive potential of this process, the fact that its final outcome would be psycho-spiritual death and rebirth, the effect can be exactly the opposite. They have the feeling that something fantastic would happen to them if they could experience the destructive force of fire. This expectation can be so strong that it results in an irresistible urge to actually start a fire. The observation of the resulting conflagration brings only transient excitement and tends to be disappointing. However, the feeling that the experience of fire should bring a phenomenal liberation is so convincing and compelling that these people try again and become arsonists. Pyrophobia is thus paradoxically closely related to pyromania, from Greek mania, meaning frenzy. Hydrophobia, the pathological fear of water, also typically has a strong perinatal component. This reflects the fact that water plays an important role in connection to childbirth. If the pregnancy and delivery have a normal course, this connection is very positive. In that case, water represents the comfort of the amniotic existence or of the postnatal period, when receiving a bath indicates that the danger of birth is over. However, various prenatal crises, such as inhalation of the amniotic fluid during birth or postnatal bathing accidents, can give water a distinctly negative charge. The coex systems underlying hydrophobia also typically contain biographical elements, traumatic experiences with water in infancy and childhood, and transpersonal elements, shipwreck, flood, or drowning in a previous incarnation. Conversion hysteria. This psychoneurosis, much more prevalent in Freud's time than it is today, played an important role in the history and development of psychoanalysis. Several of Freud's patients, and many of his followers' patients, belong to this diagnostic category. The name of this disorder is derived from the Greek hystera, meaning uterus, because it was initially considered an exclusively female disorder. This belief was later disproved and abandoned. Conversion hysteria has a rich and colorful symptomatology and, according to the psychogenetic taxonomy constructed by Berlin's psychoanalyst Carl Abraham, it is closely related to the group of phobias or anxiety hysteria. This means that the major fixation for this disorder is on the phallic stage of libidinal development, and that the psychosexual trauma which underlies it occurred at the time when the child was under a strong influence of the Electra or Oedipus complex. Of the several defense mechanisms involved in the psychogenesis of conversion hysteria, the most characteristic one is conversion, which gave this form of hysteria its name. This term refers to the symbolic transformation of unconscious conflicts and instinctual impulses into physical symptoms. Examples of the physical manifestations which affect motor functions include paralysis of arms or legs, abasia, astasia, loss of speech, aphonia, and vomiting. Conversion that affects sensory organs and functions can result in temporary blindness, deafness, or psychogenic anesthesia. Conversion hysteria can also produce a combination of symptoms that convincingly imitate pregnancy. This false pregnancy, or pseudocyesis, involves amenorrhea, morning nausea and vomiting, and a sizable extension of the abdominal cavity caused by retention of gases in the intestines. Religious stigmata, simulating the wounds of Jesus, have also often been interpreted as hysterical conversions. Freud suggested that in hysterical conversions, repressed sexual thoughts and impulses find their expression in changes of physical functions. The affected organ is effectively sexualized, that is, it becomes a symbolic substitute for genitals. For example, hyperemia and the swelling of various organs might symbolize erection, or abnormal feelings or physiological changes in these organs might imitate genital sensations. Freud, for example, accepted the theory of his close friend, otorhinolaryngologist Wilhelm Fliess, who believed that blushing of the face is displaced sexual excitement and picking the nose is a surrogate for masturbation. Freud even sent some of his hysterical patients to have their nasal septum surgically broken, an intervention that Fliess recommended as treatment for this disorder. Freud also suggested that, in some instances, the emerging memory of a traumatic situation can be understood by the physical sensations that the individual was experiencing at that time. The most complex and distinctive manifestation of hysteria is a specific psychosomatic syndrome referred to as a major hysterical spell or attack. It is a condition characterized by fainting, syncope, breathing difficulties, extreme backward arching of the body on the floor, alternating crying and laughter, flailing around, and pelvic movements resembling sexual intercourse. According to Freud, hysterical spells are pantomimic expressions of forgotten events from childhood and of fantasy stories constructed around these events. These spells represent disguised sexual themes related to the Oedipus and Electra complex and their derivatives. Freud pointed out that the behavior during hysterical spells clearly betrays their sexual nature. He compared the loss of consciousness at the height of the attack to the momentary loss of consciousness during sexual orgasm. Observations from holotropic states show that conversion hysteria, in addition to the biographical determinants, also has significant perinatal and transpersonal roots. Underlying conversion phenomena in general, and hysterical spells in particular, are powerful bioenergetic blockages which have conflicting innervations related to the dynamics of BPM-3. The behavior of people reliving the final stage of birth, especially the characteristic deflection of the head and extreme backward arching, often resembles a hysterical spell. The nature and timing of the biographical material involved in the psychogenesis of conversion hysteria are in basic agreement with the Freudian theory. Experiential work typically reveals psychosexual traumas from the period of childhood when the patient reached the phallic stage of development and was under the influence of the Oedipus or Electra complex. The movements in the hysterical attack can be shown to represent, in addition to the mentioned perinatal elements, symbolic allusions to certain specific aspects of the underlying childhood trauma. The sexual content of the traumatic memories associated with conversion hysteria explains why they are part of a coex system that also includes the sexual facet of BPM-3. If we are not familiar with the fact that the memory of birth has a strong sexual element, it is easy to overlook the perinatal contribution to the genesis of conversion hysteria and attribute this disorder entirely to postnatal influences. It is interesting to mention in this context Freud's own observation and admission that the leading themes underlying hysterical spells often were not sexual seduction or intercourse, but pregnancy or childbirth. The involvement of BPM-3 in the psychogenesis of conversion hysteria explains many important aspects that have often been mentioned but never adequately explained in psychoanalytic literature. It is, above all, the fact that the analysis of hysterical symptoms reveals not only their connection to libidinal impulses and sexual orgasm, but also to erection, generalized to the entire body, birth orgasm, and quite explicitly to childbirth and pregnancy. The same is true for strange links that exist in conversion hysteria between sexuality, aggression, and death. The struggle for breath is also a feature that hysterical attack has in common with reliving birth. This suggests that the best approach to a hysterical attack is to treat it as an experiential session. Encourage the full expression of emotions and physical sensations. This might prove to actually be a therapeutic opportunity for treating the underlying condition. The psychodynamic basis of conversion hysteria is quite similar to that of agitated depression. This becomes evident when we look at the most striking and dramatic expression of this disorder, the major hysterical spell. In general, agitated depression is a more serious disorder than conversion hysteria, and it manifests the content and dynamics of BPM-3 in a much purer form. Observing the facial expressions and behavior of a patient with agitated depression leaves no doubt that there are reasons for grave concern. This impression is supported by the high incidence of suicide and even murder combined with suicide that is found in these patients. A major hysterical spell shows a superficial resemblance to agitated depression. However, the overall picture is obviously far less severe, and it lacks the depth of despair. It appears stylized and contrived, and has definite theatrical features with unmistakable sexual overtones. In general, a hysterical attack has many basic characteristics of BPM-3, excessive tension, psychomotor excitement and agitation, a mixture of depression and aggression, loud screaming, disturbances of breathing, and dramatic arching. However, the basic experiential template appears here in a considerably more mitigated form than in agitated depression, and is substantially modified and colored by later traumatic events. The dynamic connection between conversion hysteria, agitated depression, and BPM-3 becomes evident in the course of deep experiential therapy. At first, the holotropic states tend to trigger or amplify hysterical symptoms, and the client discovers their source in specific psychosexual traumas from childhood. Typically, later sessions increasingly resemble agitated depression and eventually reveal the underlying elements of BPM-3. Reliving birth and the connection to BPM-4 then brings alleviation or even disappearance of the symptoms. The deepest roots of hysterical conversions can reach to the transpersonal level and take the form of karmic memories or archetypal motifs. Hysterical paralysis of the hands and arms, inability to stand, abasia, loss of speech, aphonia, and other conversion symptoms also have strong perinatal components. These conditions are not caused by lack of motor impulses, but by a dynamic conflict of antagonistic motor impulses that cancel each other. This situation comes from the painful and stressful experience of childbirth, during which the child's body responds with an excessive, chaotic generation of neural impulses for which there is no adequate discharge. A similar interpretation of hysterical conversion symptoms was first suggested by Otto Rank in his pioneering book, The Trauma of Birth. While Freud saw conversions as expressions of a psychological conflict in body language, Rank believed that their real basis was physiological, reflecting the original situation that existed during birth. The problem for Freud was how a primarily psychological problem could be translated into a physical symptom. Rank had to face the opposite problem, to explain how a primarily somatic phenomenon could acquire, through a secondary elaboration, psychological content, and symbolic meaning. Some serious manifestations of hysteria that border on psychosis, such as psychogenic stupor, uncontrolled daydreaming, and mistaking fantasy for reality, pseudologia fantastica, seem to be dynamically related to BPM-1. They reflect a deep need to reinstitute the blissful emotional condition characteristic of the undisturbed intrauterine existence and the symbiotic union with the mother. While the component of emotional and physical satisfaction involved in these states can easily be detected as surrogates of the desired good womb and good breast situation, the concrete content of daydreaming and fantasies uses themes and elements related to the individual's childhood, adolescence, and adult life. In recent decades, classical conversion hysteria, which was a very common occurrence during my medical studies and early years of my psychiatric practice, 1950s and 1960s, has become a very rare psychiatric disorder. Obsessive-compulsive neurosis. Patients suffering from obsessive-compulsive disorders are tormented by intrusive, irrational thoughts that they cannot get rid of, and they feel compelled to perform certain absurd and meaningless repetitive rituals. They are usually aware that their thought processes and behavior are irrational and even bizarre, but they are not able to control them. If they refuse to comply with these strange urges, they are overwhelmed by free-floating anxiety that can be excruciating. The spectrum of obsessive-compulsive thinking and behavior covers a wide range, from innocent playful behavior and psychopathology of everyday life to torturous ordeals that make ordinary life impossible. Many people leaving for a vacation walk out of the house with a packed suitcase and suddenly experience a creeping feeling that they have forgotten an important item at home or did not turn off the light or stove. They have to go back to the house to check the situation, and by doing so, they reach closure. A person suffering from OCD will have to keep returning again and again to check the checking and the checking of the checking, and will miss the train or flight. I was born in Prague and lived there until the age of 36. The streets in much of the city had sidewalks decorated with beautiful patterns made of small black, gray, white, and red granite cubes. Many people walking on the streets had, on and off, an impulse to walk on the sidewalk in a particular distinct pattern, stepping on areas of the same color, meandering in a specific way, or avoiding certain geometrical formations. But my OCD patients tended to get caught in this game for several hours, unable to leave, because they experienced an abysmal fear whenever they tried to stop. The problem for one of my OCD patients was that he had to imagine a system of Cartesian coordinates whenever he encountered something that evoked a strong emotional reaction in him, such as meeting an attractive girl. He went through an agonizing process of trying to find a proper place in the correct quarter of the diagram for that person or event, with satisfying distances from the abscissa and ordinate. In his LSD session, he realized that this laborious thought process was reflecting the conflicting vectors involved in having his head caught and squeezed in the birth canal. There seems to be a general agreement in psychoanalytic literature that conflicts related to homosexuality, aggression, and biological material form the psychodynamic basis of this disorder. Other common features are inhibition of genitality and a strong emphasis on pregenital drives, particularly those that are anal in nature. These aspects of the obsessive-compulsive neurosis point to a strong perinatal component, particularly to the scatological aspect of BPM3. Another characteristic feature of this neurosis is strong ambivalence concerning religion and God. Many obsessive-compulsive patients live in a constant severe conflict about God and religious faith, and experience strong rebellious and blasphemous thoughts, feelings, and impulses. For example, they associate the image of God with masturbation or defecation, or have an irresistible temptation to laugh aloud, scream obscenities, or pass gas in a church or at a funeral. This alternates with desperate desires to repent, expiate, and punish themselves to undo their transgressions, blasphemy, and sins. As discussed in the section on the phenomenology of perinatal matrices, this close association of sexual, aggressive, and scatological impulses with the numinous and divine element is characteristic for the transition between BPM3 and BPM4. Similarly, a strong conflict between the rebellion against an overwhelming force, alternating with a wish to surrender to it, is characteristic for the final stages of the death-rebirth process. In holotropic states, this unrelenting authoritative force can be experienced in an archetypal figurative form. It can manifest as a strict, punishing, and cruel God, comparable to Yahweh of the Old Testament, or even a fierce pre-Columbian deity demanding bloody sacrifice. The biological correlate of this punishing deity is the restricting influence of the birth canal that inflicts extreme, life-threatening suffering on the individual, and at the same time prevents any external expression of the instinctual energies of sexual and aggressive nature that are activated by the ordeal of biological birth. The constricting force of the birth canal represents the biological basis for the part of the superego that Freud called savage. It is a primitive and barbaric element of the psyche that can drive an individual to cruel self-punishment, automutilation, or even violent suicide. Freud saw this part of the superego as being instinctive in nature and thus a derivative of the id. Postnatally, the restrictive and coercive influence takes far more subtle forms of injunctions and prohibitions, which come from parental authorities, legal institutions, and religious commandments. This is the polar opposite of yet another aspect of the superego, Freud's ideal ego, das ideale Ich, which expresses our wish to identify with and emulate the person whom we admire. An important perinatal source of obsessive-compulsive neurosis is the unpleasant or even life-threatening encounter with various forms of biological material in the final stages of birth. The coex systems that are psychogenetically associated with this disorder involve traumatic experiences related to the anal zone and to biological material, such as a history of strict toilet training, painful enemas, anal rape, and gastrointestinal diseases. Another important category of related biographical material includes memories of various situations representing a threat to genital organization, circumcision, operation for phimosis. Quite regularly, transpersonal elements with similar themes play an important role in the genesis of this difficult condition. The obsessions, compulsions to ritual behavior, conflicts about religion and sexuality, and the anxiety which arises when the individual tries to resist and control these symptoms can be truly excruciating and torturous. After 1949, when the Portuguese neurosurgeon Edgar Moniz received a Nobel Prize for a controversial mutilating neurosurgical procedure, prefrontal lobotomy, from Greek lobos, meaning cerebral lobe, and temnin, meaning cut. Severe cases of this disorder were, together with chronic schizophrenics, considered indications for this barbaric operation. On the positive side, a study conducted at the University of Arizona found a temporary alleviation of symptoms in patients suffering from obsessive-compulsive disorder after the administration of psilocybin. Depression, mania, and suicidal behavior. Mainstream theories concerning the etiology of manic depressive disorders have undergone many changes during the last several decades. The literature on this topic has been vast and speculations varied. They are well summarized in encyclopedic books by Goodwin and Jameson. Here I make reference only to the main conceptual trends. In the 1940s and 1950s, much of the attention of mainstream professionals was focused on psychoanalytic theories of manic depressive disorders. Classical psychoanalysis linked these disorders to fixation on the active oral phase and saw suicide as aggression toward introjected hated objects, e.g. killing of the introjected breast of the bad mother. In the 1960s, the emphasis shifted to neurochemical explanations implicating, for example, low levels or imbalance of neurotransmitters. Catecholamines, adrenaline and noradrenaline, serotonin and dopamine. Neuropeptides, signaling networks, and abnormal cellular metabolism. Later researchers concluded that the etiology of manic disorders is less specific and more complex, and that it depends on a combination of genetic and other biological factors, psychological influences, and the social environmental situation. The most recent speculations attribute an important role in the genesis of affective disorders to the abnormal connectivity of neural networks in the brain's regulatory systems, oscillation patterns, and biological rhythms. Various biological theories of manic depressive disorders indicate only the propensity for manic and depressive episodes, but fail to explain why the episodes take the form of one or the other. They also offer no clues for understanding the specifics of the clinical symptomatology of either of them. Paradoxically, although the manic and depressive phases seem to represent polar opposites in their clinical picture, they both show increased activity as indicated by biochemical parameters of stress and peak oscillatory activity of biological rhythms. Observations from holotropic research, though, might help to understand and resolve these controversies. The early statistical and diagnostic manuals, DSM-1 and 2, paid attention to etiological factors and showed strong psychoanalytic influences. Later versions of the manual intentionally avoided etiological, biological, and psychodynamic speculations and chose the neo-Kraepelinian approach, which focuses only on the description of symptoms and syndromes. It would be impossible to relate the new insights from holotropic research to such vague concepts as the multifactorial etiology of manic depressive disorders or a simple description of symptoms and syndromes. I have therefore decided to revise and deepen the original explanations of emotional and psychosomatic disorders in classical psychoanalysis, which was imperfect but at least aimed in the right direction. In classical psychoanalysis, depression and mania were seen as disorders that are related to serious problems in the active, sadistic or cannibalistic oral period, such as interference with nursing, emotional rejection and deprivation, and difficulties in the early mother-child relationship. Suicidal tendencies were then interpreted as acts of hostility against an introjected object. The image of the bad mother, primarily her breast. In view of the observations from holotropic states, this picture has to be revised and substantially deepened. In its original form, it is implausible and unconvincing, and does not explain some very fundamental clinical observations regarding depression. For example, why do we have two radically different forms in which depression manifests, the inhibited and the agitated variety? Why are depressed people typically bioenergetically blocked, as exemplified by a high incidence of headaches, pressure on the chest and shoulders, psychosomatic pains, and retention of water? Why are they physiologically inhibited and show loss of appetite, gastrointestinal dysfunction, constipation, no interest in sex, and amenorrhea? Why do individuals who are depressed, including those who have an inhibited depression, show high levels of biochemical stress? Why do they feel hopeless and often describe themselves as feeling stuck? Why is depression so closely related to suicide and mania? Why do mania and depression, disorders that seem to be polar opposites to the extent that it is reflected in clinical terminology, bipolar disorder, both show an increase in biochemical indicators of stress and an oscillatory activity of biological rhythms? These questions cannot be answered by psychotherapeutic schools that are conceptually limited to postnatal biography and the Freudian individual unconscious. Even less successful in this regard are theories that try to explain manic depressive disorders simply as results of chemical aberrations in the organism. It is highly unlikely that a chemical change could, in and of itself, account for the complexity of the clinical picture of depression, including its close link with mania and suicide. This difficult situation changes dramatically once we realize that these disorders have significant perinatal and transpersonal roots. We start seeing many of the problems mentioned earlier in an entirely new light, and many of the manifestations of depression suddenly appear logical. Inhibited depressions have important roots in the second perinatal matrix. The phenomenology of the sessions governed by BPM-2, as well as the periods immediately following poorly resolved experiences dominated by this matrix, exhibit all the essential features of deep depression. The person who is under the influence of BPM-2 experiences agonizing mental and emotional pain, hopelessness, despair, overwhelming feelings of guilt, and a sense of inadequacy. He or she feels deep anxiety, lack of initiative, loss of interest, and an inability to enjoy existence. In this state, life appears to be utterly meaningless, emotionally empty, and absurd. One's own life and the world itself are seen as if through a negative stencil, with selective awareness of the painful, bad, and tragic aspects of life, and blindness toward anything positive. This situation appears to be utterly unbearable, inescapable, and hopeless. Sometimes this is accompanied by the loss of the ability to see colors. When that happens, the entire world is perceived as a black and white film. In spite of the extreme suffering involved, this condition is not associated with crying or any other dramatic external manifestations. It is characterized by a general motor inhibition. As I mentioned earlier, inhibited depression is associated with bioenergetic blockages in various parts of the body, and the severe inhibition of major physiological functions. Typical physical concomitants of this form of depression are feelings of oppression, constriction and confinement, a sense of suffocation, tensions and pressures in different parts of the body, and headaches. It's also very common to have retention of water and urine, constipation, cardiac distress, and a loss of interest in food and sex, as well as having a tendency toward hypochondriacal interpretations of various physical symptoms. All of these symptoms are consistent with the understanding of this type of depression as a manifestation of BPM-2. This is further supported by paradoxical biochemical findings. People suffering from inhibited depression typically show a high degree of stress, as indicated by the elevation of catecholamines and steroid hormones in the blood and urine. This biochemical picture fits well with BPM-2, which represents a highly stressful inner situation with no possibility of external action or manifestation. Sitting on the outside, running on the inside. The theory of psychoanalysis links depression to early oral problems and emotional deprivation. Although this connection is correct, it does not account for important aspects of depression: the sense of being stuck, hopelessness with feelings of no exit, and bioenergetic blockage, as well as the physical manifestations, including the biochemical findings. The present model shows the Freudian explanation as essentially correct but partial. While the COEX systems associated with inhibited depression include biographical elements emphasized by psychoanalysis, a fuller and more comprehensive understanding has to include the dynamics of BPM-2. The early deprivation and oral frustration has much in common with BPM-2, and the inclusion of both of these situations in the same COEX system reflects deep experiential logic. BPM-2 involves the interruption of the symbiotic connection between the fetus and the maternal organism, which is caused by uterine contractions and the resulting compression of the arteries. This severing and loss of the biologically and emotionally meaningful contact with the mother terminates the supply of oxygen, nourishment, and warmth to the fetus. Additional consequences of the uterine contractions are a temporary accumulation of toxic products in the body of the fetus and an exposure to an unpleasant and potentially dangerous situation. It thus makes good sense that the typical constituents of COEX systems dynamically related to inhibited depression and to BPM-2 involve separation from and absence of the mother during infancy and early childhood, and the ensuing feelings of loneliness, cold, hunger, and fear. They represent, in a sense, a higher octave of the more acute and disturbing deprivation caused during the delivery by the uterine contractions. More superficial layers of the relevant COEX systems reflect family situations that are oppressive and punishing for the child, and permit no rebellion or escape. They also often include memories of playing the role of scapegoat in various peer groups, having abusive employers, and suffering political or social oppression. All these situations reinforce and perpetuate the role of helpless victim in the no-exit predicament characteristic of BPM-2. An important category of COEX systems that is instrumental in the dynamics of depression involves memories of events that constituted a physical insult and threat to survival or body integrity, and in which the individual was effectively a helpless victim. This observation is an entirely new contribution to the understanding of depressions, thanks to holotropic research. Psychoanalysts and psychodynamically oriented academic psychiatrists emphasize the role of psychological factors in the pathogenesis of depression and do not take psychotraumas from physical insults into consideration. The psychotraumatic effects of serious diseases, injuries, operations, long-term confinement in a plaster cast for inadequately developed hip joints, and episodes of near drowning have been overlooked and grossly underestimated by mainstream psychiatrists. This is very surprising in view of their general emphasis on biological factors. For theoreticians and clinicians who see depression as a result of fixation on the oral period of libidinal development, the finding that physical traumas play an important role in the development of this disorder represents a serious conceptual challenge. It seems perfectly logical, though, in the context of the presented model, which attributes pathogenic significance to coex systems that include the combined emotional-physical trauma of birth. This fact helps to bridge the gap between academics and clinicians who prefer to emphasize biological factors in the genesis of psychiatric disorders and those who seek psychological explanation. The psychological factors thus do not cause physical symptoms and vice versa. They both have their source in the experience of birth and represent two sides of the same coin. In contrast to the inhibited depression, the phenomenology of agitated depression is psychodynamically associated with BPM-3. Its basic elements are governed by the third matrix, which can be seen in experiential sessions and post-session intervals. The pent-up energies from birth are not completely blocked, as is the case in inhibited depression, in relation to BPM-2. In this situation, the previously jammed energies find a partial outlet and discharge in the form of various destructive and self-destructive tendencies. It is important to emphasize that agitated depression reflects a dynamic compromise between an energetic block and discharge. A full discharge of these energies would terminate this condition and result in healing. Characteristic features of this type of depression are a high degree of tension, anxiety, psychomotor excitement, and restlessness. People experiencing agitated depression are very active. They tend to roll on the floor, flail around, and beat their heads against the wall. Their emotional pain finds expression in loud crying and screaming, and they might scratch their faces and tear their hair and clothes. Physical symptoms that are often associated with this condition are muscular tensions, tremors, painful cramps, and uterine and intestinal spasms. Intense headaches, nausea, and breathing problems complete the clinical picture. The coex systems associated with this matrix deal with aggression and violence, cruelties of various kinds, sexual abuse and assaults, painful medical interventions, and diseases involving choking and a struggle for breath. In contrast with the coex systems related to BPM-2, the subjects involved in these situations are not passive victims. They are actively engaged in attempts to fight back, defend themselves, remove the obstacles, or escape. Memories of violent encounters with parental figures or siblings, fist fights with peers, scenes of sexual abuse and rape, and episodes from military battles are typical examples. The psychoanalytic interpretation of mania is even less satisfactory and convincing than that of depression, as many analysts themselves admit. However, most authors seem to agree that mania represents a means of avoiding the awareness of the underlying depression, and that it includes a denial of a painful inner reality and flight into the external world. It reflects the victory of the ego and the id over the superego, with a drastic reduction of inhibitions, an increase of self-esteem, and an abundance of sensual and aggressive impulses. In spite of all this, mania does not give the impression of genuine freedom. Psychological theories of manic depressive disorders emphasize the intensive ambivalence of manic patients and the fact that simultaneous feelings of love and hate interfere with their ability to relate to others. The typical manic hunger for objects is usually seen as a manifestation of a strong oral fixation. And the periodicity of mania and depression is considered an indication of its relation to the cycle of satiety and hunger. Many of the otherwise puzzling features of manic episodes become easily understandable when seen in relation to the dynamics of the perinatal matrices. Mania is psychogenetically linked to the experiential transition from BPM-3 to BPM-4. It indicates that the individual is partially in touch with the fourth perinatal matrix, but nevertheless still under the influence of the third. To be peaceful, to sleep, and to eat, the typical triad of wishes found in mania, are the natural goals of an organism flooded by the impulses associated with the final stage of birth. Since the manic person has regressed all the way to the level of biological birth, the oral impulses are progressive and not regressive in nature. They point to the state that the manic individual is craving and aiming for and has not yet consciously achieved, rather than representing regression on the oral level. Relaxation and oral satisfaction are characteristic of the state following biological birth. In experiential psychotherapy, one can occasionally observe transient manic episodes in statu nascendi as phenomena suggesting incomplete rebirth. This usually happens when the individuals involved in the transformation process have reached the final stage of the death-rebirth struggle and have gotten a taste of the feelings of release from the birth agony. However, at the same time, they are afraid, unwilling, and unable to face the remaining unresolved material related to BPM-3 and experience the ego death. As a result of clinging to this uncertain and tenuous victory, the new positive feelings become accentuated to the point of a caricature. The image of whistling in the dark seems to fit this condition particularly well. The exaggerated and forceful nature of manic emotions and behavior betrays that they are not expressions of genuine joy and freedom, but reaction formations to fear and aggression. I have often observed that LSD subjects whose sessions terminate in a state of incomplete rebirth show all the typical signs of mania. They are hyperactive, move around at a hectic pace, try to socialize and fraternize with everybody in their environment, make inappropriate advances, and talk incessantly about their sense of triumph and well-being, wonderful feelings, and the great experience they have just had.